Without question, how to intro this guest for this podcast is one of the most fun challenges I've faced in about 10 years doing this, and I'm barely kidding. And the reason is so valid. How do you put Tom Zaki, recycling pioneer, eco-capitalist, author, and founder and CEO of TerraCycle into a soundbite or a bio or a rational, normal description? The answer is you don't. It's kind of because he's indescribable, and it's kind of because he is always up to something new, something exciting, something impactful, discovering or creating out-of-the-box recycling solutions that are good for the people he works with and good for the planet. Tom is really fun, and he's really funny. He consistently sets out to do the impossible, eliminate all waste. He sees a future with a circular economy that relies on responsible reuse and recycling to propel the world towards eradicating overconsumption and waste. Tom Zaki is truly one of a kind when it comes to making our world a better place in innovative, sometimes funky, and always impactful ways. He is truly an ultimate disruptor for good, and you don't want to miss a minute of what he has to share. Hi there, it's me, Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks so much for being a part of it. On a serious note, when facing the many challenges on our planet, which you often hear about on our podcasts, it's important to sometimes focus on the opportunities, to imagine what is possible, to look at solutions, which is exactly why I'm excited to get to spend time with Tom Zaki. One might think he looks through the lens of seeing waste everywhere, but he doesn't. He looks through the lens of what can we do with it. He thinks about closing loops as the thought leader at TerraCycle, an organization that presents yet another challenge for me to describe because it's kind of indescribable too. TerraCycle is an innovative recycling company that has become a global leader in the recycling, hard-to-recycle waste arena, and it's hard to articulate the difference that they have made and continue to make for this great planet of ours. So, Tom, enough already. I wanted to go into how do you recycle chewing gum, and the list goes on, but
yeah. You
can tell that I'm really thrilled to have you here, and I'm thrilled that you're joining us from the Garden State, the home of Gina Murphy Darling and Mrs. Green. So thanks for taking the time.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, let's start with the first R. You get it.
Yeah.
It's reduce. And we need to be not talking as much about recycling our waste, but our consumption. And you've been leading the way with that charge.
Get
us inspired. And go.
Yeah, no, for sure. So I think I'm so glad, by the way, you started with even the three R's, because the first sustainability lesson we learn as children is reduce, reuse, recycle. You know, so there's something magical about the simplicity of that, especially in the context of how complicated, gray, and difficult to capture other sustainability issues are, like palm oil or climate change or other incredibly important things like species reduction or deforestation. You know, how is the burning of the Amazon right now linked to us ordering a hamburger? And how is that a connected action? So one of the beautiful things about waste is its sheer simplicity. And I'm glad you asked the question and starting with the first R, because that is the big white elephant in the room, I think, across all sustainability actions or questions, whether it's waste or water or you name it, is they're all driven by one action that we as consumers make. In fact, we as individuals are the god of the equation, and usually we don't give ourselves any credit. Usually we think we're just susceptible to the big macroeconomic forces of, you know, countries and big companies and so on. And that is our act of purchasing. Consumption, the creation of goods, is what creates effectively every environmental problem in the world. You know, it's ordering a hamburger leads to deforestation in the Amazon. Purchasing a product leads to plastic waste and so many other examples. And so what we really need to think about before we get into the complexity of any of these topics, and very much look forward to talking to you about waste today, is this idea of reduce. And the most awesome version of reduce is the act of not buying. So even, let's say, one step further of refusing to buy. But within reduce, it's all about how do we consume less And then once we have accomplished lessening our consumption, which is a very difficult thing to do within our cultural setting today, then it's how do we increase the quality of that by looking at things that can be more circular versus more linear. And this begins before we even think about recycling or anything, because it would avoid the need for it. And it's something that I think we should all center on, because we are voting multiple times a day for the future we want to live in, you know, not with a political vote, but with the economic vote of what we purchase.
And you said, you know, it hit a nerve with me, and I'm glad there are no hidden cameras in my house. At least I hope they're not. I mean, the Russians may have visited me, but I'm not sure. But there was something on 60 Minutes about Boyan and his machine that's taking waste out of the ocean. And that's great because it's a problem. It's an expensive solution. And I'm sitting there pretty much screaming at the TV, you're missing an opportunity here, announcers and journalists and interviewers. Nobody's saying anything about the solution is not necessarily taking the waste out of the ocean. It's about not putting it there in the first place. And I was like, I kind of came undone because we have to keep raising that issue. Reduce, reduce, reduce.
Yes, you're right. And by the way, Boyan is a friend of mine, you know, and he has done phenomenal work with the ocean cleanup and getting a phenomenal amount of capital raised. I think he's raised just under $40 million to build his devices, huge amount of research, learnings, and so on. And it's quite amazing, you know, what he's been able to do. And also credit to all the other folks, you know, that work in the same space as Boyan who are helping clean up our oceans. We do some of that as well at TerraCycle. If you add all the work together, you know, and what's been taken out by everyone, it's probably, to your point, what goes in within, I don't know, a few minutes. And it's just incomparable, the scale of what we create versus what we're able to clean up.
And I certainly didn't in any way mean to diminish the incredible work he's done and his vision for how we can get it out, because it's in there. But my point was, we needed the people that were doing the interview to have that opportunity to say, this is horrible, even in their closing. And what we all have to think about is how we keep it from getting there in the first place. So let's talk about garbage. I mean, you know what a big problem it is. You've been doing it for a long time. It's global. It's absolutely everywhere. And it's not going away. But I read an article that you wrote about dissecting garbage, what it really is. It's, why does it exist?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is very important as a framing question on if you're going to solve any problem, you know, whether it's a human rights issue like female empowerment or immigration or an environmental issue like, let's say, species reduction. It's, I think, critically important not just to say, here's the issue and how do we make it better, but understand why does the issue exist to begin with? Because understanding that, you suddenly start unlocking the way the issue exists. How does it breathe? How does it grow? What does it need to exist? What does it need to be solved? And so on. And let's take a moment on garbage, right? Garbage is a completely man-made phenomenon. It doesn't exist in nature in any capacity. So organisms in nature have outputs, right? A chimpanzee will output carbon dioxide when it exhales. It'll have its fecal matter in urine when it goes to the toilet. It'll have its body parts, you know, that come off in its life, like hair or nail clippings. But it will also one day have the whole physical body will die and you'll have a carcass. Those will be the outputs that you see from, say, a chimpanzee. And we have all three of those. What's unique in those outputs is that while the chimpanzee can't use those outputs again for its own purpose, it can't inhale carbon, eat its, you know, fecal matter, those would all be inoptimal solutions. Other organisms view those outputs as useful inputs, not just inputs they can use, but inputs they want to use. You know, the trees will inhale the carbon and survive off that. Microorganisms will eat the fecal matter and so on and so forth. The challenge is that in the human system, we have all these outputs that are useless to us and useless to every other organism out there. And that is what waste is. Now, that's a very modern idea. In fact, that only came about in the 1950s. So we're talking, it's an idea that's 70 years old. I mean, it's important that we don't just accept it as a truth that's been around forever. It's been around for just a few generations. And what brought it about was the shift that happened right after the Second World War from giving sort of, you know, focus on durable, long-lasting product design made out of things like wood and metal, glass that nature knew what to do with or were benign to nature, and shifting that to fast-paced, disposable consumerism based on plastic and other complex materials nature has no systems for and doesn't know what to do with and actually pollute nature if they break down in a natural system. And that all came about in the past 70 years. Now, the next question then becomes, okay, well, what systems did we create to solve for this? And you'd point to the waste management industry, this huge industry that's created to deal with waste. And one of the interesting things about the waste management industry is that, and this is what I love about the garbage industry, it's the only industry that will one day own everything you possess with not a single exception. I mean, what industry can say, I will own everything you have today, just a matter of time? Yet the garbage industry can say that on everything. And what's strange about this is that with the way it works, if you simplify, and I preface to say that, say, in Canada, Waste Connections, the largest Canadian garbage company, owns 25% of our Canadian business. Or in Europe, Suez purchased, which is the largest European waste management company, purchased 30% of our Western European business. And many other examples like that have occurred. So we know this industry from the inside out. And what they do, what a garbage company does, is it will first look at your waste and think about, what can I take out of that and sell it a profit? And that's what we call recycling. It's urban mining. It's not about doing the right thing. It's not about anything other than, hey, it's profitable for me to take those things out of your garbage and sell them to someone else. And that happens to be things like your aluminum can and, you know, simple paper. I mean, a simple way to sort of think about this is, imagine if you were a like a junk hauler, you know, that was called to your home and you had all this stuff that you needed me to get rid of, you know, like clothing and furniture. But if you had a nice Steinway piano there, I would likely not throw that in a landfill. I'd take it and sell it somewhere else. And that's recycling. And then everything I can't sell at a profit is what the garbage company focuses on disposing as cheaply as possible within the laws of the land, which in US, because it's unregulated, would be landfilling. In Europe or Japan or other more regulated environments, it would be things like waste to energy, because landfills are typically outlawed in more regulated or wealthier environments. And that's effectively what a garbage company does. So, you know, and all of it rests, by the way, on the value of the materials waste is made from. That's what drives the entire equation, is the value of the aluminum in your can or the value of the paper in your coffee cup and so on and so forth. And that framing, once you understand sort of where it comes from, why it exists, and then what are the solutions today, suddenly start opening up the opportunities for how to bring solutions where there are none today. Like, how do you get a dirty diaper recycled, or chewing gum, or other innovative ideas?
So what do you say? This is what, you know, I told you when I saw you at Planet Forward that Albie Zakes was one of the first guests I ever had on my show. I was on terrestrial radio. I discovered TerraCycle, because who doesn't when you first start into the environmental education movement? What's changed? What's innovative? Like, you do focus a lot on the positive when you talk to people. What are people and countries and corporations doing differently now than when you started? You know, what excites you?
Yeah, absolutely. It is, I would say, a very exciting time for the sustainability movement, and especially the within that waste. And it doesn't, it's sort of funny, because if you look at sort of what's happening in the world, you know, you'd say, how could it be such a moment, right? And I, you know, I've been doing TerraCycle now for over 15 years. And for all those 15 years, garbage has always been seen as a problem. I've never once had an experience where someone says garbage is a good thing. But in the past 24 months, it's moved from a problem to a crisis. And that elevation to everyone accepting it as a crisis, all over the world, has spurred organizations, companies, retailers, brands, manufacturers, governments, even individuals, to think about what they can do to help solve the crisis, because that's what being in a crisis galvanizes. And to me, that's really interesting. If you look at how does that come about, it always comes about first by the individual people getting pissed off and getting upset and raising their voice. That's why, you know, it's so important. Like, the first topic we talked about, you know, to this, is all the power is in the hands of the consumer. And it's ironic, because I think the individual consumer doesn't think they have any power, yet the irony is they have all the power. because when we buy things, more of those things appear the next day and less of what we didn't buy. And it's exactly how it works. We're not being manipulated into buying what we don't want to buy. Instead, we are telling companies what we want and they're making more of it. This is a very, very important thing to understand. And a great metaphor of this, I heard someone, you know, once say a quote, I don't know where it was, but it went something like this, that, you know, it's always been taught in religion that God made man in his image. But isn't the truth that man made God in his image? Right? And I think that's the same idea that's happening in consumerism, is we think we're just, you know, sheep, you know, to the slaughter of large companies and their desires, when it's exactly the opposite that happens. We control it all, we just don't know it. And that's scary. So we need to be very, very, very aware of the power we have and wield it appropriately. So the first thing that happens in this sort of crisis is the consumers, you know, rile up. And I think where it started, some say it was Blue Planet 2, the Sir David Attenborough documentary that really woke people up. Some say it was that sort of Facebook or social media image of the turtle with the straw up its nose. There could have been many options, but those examples all happened at the same time and people woke up in arms. What that then happens is that the politicians, frankly, to score points with their electorate, start passing laws, banning plastic bags, banning plastic straws. I mean, how many places have we seen the plastic straw die?
Right.
Ironic, because it's like just a little tiny part of the waste stream, but nevertheless, you know, that started happening. Canada, a month ago, passed a law banning dangerous single-use plastics. Europe is banning all sorts of disposable items. When then the corporate realm starts seeing the consumers behave this way and start voting differently with their money, start seeing politicians react by passing legislation or regulations, then they say, gosh, we really need to get ahead of this and start really investing in solutions. And that's the magic of what's happening right now, is that there's a huge momentum in companies looking at how do we do the right thing and consumers trying to support that. The way we try to react to that at TerraCycle is, by definition, we try to do what a normal garbage company doesn't do. That's not because one is good or bad. It's because there's already a lot of businesses out there that do what normal garbage companies do, and we feel like there's a great opportunity to do what they don't. And it's also why these garbage companies effectively also bought into us as investors. So the first thing, you know, we try to do, which is what I would say the TerraCycle brand is most famous for. If you Google TerraCycle, you're going to get a lot of information on these sort of programs, which is we try to make things that are not recyclable, recyclable. Whether it's sort of, you know, exotic things that people get very, you know, sort of grossed out by, from cigarette butts to dirty diapers to chewing gum, all the way to, you know, things that may be seen as more benign, like cosmetic packaging, toothbrushes, pens, flexible food packaging, juice pouches, and so on. And that's the first thing. And we set up these national programs. You can check out our website and participate in hundreds of free programs across 21 countries in the world, and, you know, help us collect and recycle waste. And there's all sorts of really great things that happen there. The second thing that we try to do then to sort of move towards the circular economy is, how do we help companies use recycled materials in their products to try to get it to be as circular as possible? And there we do, again, things that are not normal. So not your normal recycled paper or your recycled PET, which is a type of plastic, but ocean plastic or festival waste or roadway litter or things that are usually not collected and recycled. Then, you know, we asked ourselves the question, you know, how is really recycling even the answer to garbage? And we realized that it was an answer to the symptom of waste, but not the root cause of waste. We think the root cause of waste is this idea of disposability, or using things once. And that's what really shifted in the 1950s. We went from a society that valued craftsmanship, long-lasting products. We had the idea of repair. You know, we cobbled our shoes, we mended our clothing, we repaired our furniture, to a society, and this happened within years in the 1950s, that valued disposable items because of the amazing convenience and affordability they brought. You know, it's easy to vilify single use, but we also love it as consumers because it's so convenient and so cheap, you know, to buy a coffee cup, use it once, and throw it out. And so we vote for that all day long, which is why most coffee is served in single-use cups today. And so there, to attack that, we've brought a new platform out that we debuted in January at the World Economic Forum, and then went live in Paris and the northeast of the U.S. In May. And then we'll be launching in, I think, 7 countries over the next 12 months called Loop, which is all about shifting from back actually to the way life was like in the 1940s, but in a very modern perspective. So shifting all your favorite products, from your Tide laundry detergent to your Häagen-Dazs ice cream, from disposable packaging to durable, beautifully designed, highly functional packaging that the consumer product company buys back from you at the end. And that's sort of changing some of the paradigms of how we interact with products, making it way more sustainable, going to that second R in the 3 R's you had mentioned of reuse, and upgrading sort of our entire how we look at the products and how beautiful they are and so on. And then we also have some new ideas that we're working on, which is how do we elevate waste even more? And that's through our diagnostic platform, where we found that this is just to show you how far you can push waste, that certain waste streams carry diagnosable samples that can be collected, diagnosed, and have you live a healthier life or a more informed life. So your toothbrush has your saliva, your razor blade has your hair, your child's diaper has their fecal matter, your cat's kitty litter has a urine and fecal sample, your motor oil has your engine scrapings diluted into it, your air conditioning filter has the particulate of your home. All of these items can be collected, those items analyzed, and then you can get reports so that you can learn about the health of your home, your car, your child, your pet, yourself. And that's all about how do we rethink the role of waste, not just as a negative we have to get rid of as cheaply as possible, but of a much more valuable construct.
And I'd like you to just back up a little bit and go into a little bit more detail about the Loop, because you talked about that at Planet Forward. People got really excited about it. And I don't, unless you were there and hearing the presentation, tell us how it works and how it came about and how is it being received in the places where it's launched?
Absolutely. So I think in all these examples, right, in game-changing innovation, I think a key part of it is you got to take a step back and identify, the precursor to the issue. So if waste was invented in the 1950s, what was life like in the 1940s, 30s, any time before then, where waste didn't really exist? And what was different is that a lot of our products came in reusable packaging. Not just a lot, but like a huge amount of products. And not just your milkman, which is the archetype, but beer, motor oil, cheese, perfume. I mean, a huge range of goods came in beautiful, durable, reusable packaging. So beautiful and so durable, you can still buy them in flea markets 100 years later. Ironically, you wouldn't be able to buy a package you buy today, tomorrow at a flea market. They would joke if you were to sell a milk container we bought yesterday, right?
Right.
So that's how it used to be. Now, a really interesting thing was occurring then that I think went unnoticed is who owned the package in the end. In the end, those reusable packagings all became property of the manufacturer. They ended up back with the manufacturer. Either the manufacturer owned them the whole time, or they would put a deposit on it and then return the deposit, effectively buying back the packaging. So net-net, at the end of the day, the milkman always ended up back owning their milk bottle. So if you're going to own your packaging yourself as a company, forget sustainability. Just look at the most selfish motivation of profit. You're going to be motivated by money to make that thing last a long time, because if it breaks, you're the one who has to write it off and get a new one. So that's how it used to work. And that set up this beautiful motivation driven just from capitalism of long-lasting and durable. And then, 1950s, disposability comes onto the scene, brings about this new found convenience and affordability by moving to single-use packaging. And people didn't know all the negatives back then, and everything shifts. And we completely forget about the milkman, and the milkman goes away into history. So what Loop is trying to do with that context in mind is to think about how do we bring back that way of thinking, but not just relaunch the milkman, but to relaunch it with a lot of modern thinking and to really reboot it in a very modern way. And so what Loop does concretely, just to sort of paint it on what is your experience, is Loop creates an environment that can be embedded into retailers. So in the US, we're working with Kroger and Walgreens, soon others, all over the world with other major retailers like Tesco in the UK, Carrefour in France, Loblaw in Canada. These are the leading retailers of those countries. It's also going to be in Australia, Germany, Japan. So there's a lot coming up. And they embed Loop into their ecosystem where you would be able to buy from the Loop idea both online, say at walgreens.com/loop or kroger.com/loop or whatever, as well as later in their physical stores. There'll be some physical stores opening with Loop next year in the United States. And when you go to the section, say on their website or their store, you would see all your favorite brands. And really, like, you know, we're talking Cascade to Pepsi to Coke to Häagen-Dazs to, you know, Tide and all these major brands, where the packaging is no longer in disposable packaging, but in beautiful, durable packaging. And durable packaging isn't just doesn't just make the packaging reusable, which in all cases it is, at a minimum of 10 uses, or it's not allowed in the platform, and many times much more. But it's also beautiful design with amazing materials that allow for new functions that were never possible before in disposable packaging. So as a concrete example, take something like the Häagen-Dazs container, which is ice cream. Instead of being in coated paper, like a coffee cup, which is what ice cream is packaged in today, which, mind you, is not recyclable municipally, it's now in double-walled stainless steel. What double-walled stainless steel allows for ice cream packaging to do is not only is it reusable, which is way better for the environment, but it insulates the ice cream. So that means that the ice cream melts, not from the outside in, which is the normal melting pattern, which sucks because if you leave your ice cream out, you get a ball of ice cream floating right. In ice cream soup.
Right in the middle.
Yeah. Right. It sucks. Now it melts from the top down, which is sort of perfect. It also keeps the ice cream frozen longer. So instead of it melting quickly, especially, you know, like we were talking before we started this conversation about hot summers, instead of melting super fast, it melts, you know, much slower. It also doesn't keep your hand cold because the outside of the container can be warm while the inside is still frozen. And it's incredibly beautiful and absolutely aesthetic. So you could just leave it on your, you know, dinner party's table and not feel like you have to scoop it out onto a plate because the ice cream package is so ugly. And that's just one example of hundreds and hundreds of products that are being reinvented by the world's leading manufacturers. And they're doing this because A, it is profoundly more sustainable. It's moving up on those three R's from maybe recyclable to reusable, which is a huge step up. Remember, the only step better is not buying the product at all.
Right.
Which is the answer, by the way. And the other, though, so it does that profound sustainability upgrade, but it also is innovating in increasing the luxury and beauty of the products and function of the products in your home. Like a crazy stat is today in the United States, 40% of Americans who buy liquid dish soap, 40% pour it into a different container when they get home already. And they're doing that not because of sustainability, but because of aesthetics, that the container they pour it into is just nicer and more beautiful and just fits the, you know, the design of their home better than a disposable, you know, very loudly graphic designed container would. And so it also does that at the very same time, and that's the magic sauce. So basically, how do you do it? Today you can buy online by going to loopstore.com, but, you know, next year you'll be able to go into physical Walgreens and Kroger stores. You see the Loop assortment. You buy whatever you wish. The content costs about the same as it would in disposable packaging. The only difference is you put a deposit on those durable containers, and the deposits range depending on what type of container you're getting, but anywhere from, say, 10 cents, 20 cents on a simple beverage container all the way up to maybe $10 if it's a very advanced container. And you use it, you enjoy it, you have this elevated experience. And when you're done, and this is the key, we want you to have the convenience of disposability, which is a throwaway lifestyle. Don't think about it, throw it away. That's a very convenient thing. In fact, there's nothing wrong with that behavior. What is wrong is where the bin ends up in the end. So if you throw everything into a bin and it ends up in a landfill, that sort of sucks. But if you throw everything into a bin and it ends up at a recycling center and it actually gets recycled, that's a little better. With Loop, you throw it all into a bin, no sorting, no cleaning, but it ends up going to a reuse center where it's cleaned, sorted, sent back to the manufacturers who refill them, and around the cycle goes again. So it's allowing you to be reusable without having to clean the package, fill it yourself, you know, or any of the things that today reusable systems ask you to do. And it, I think because of that design improvement and major convenience that it brings, plus always, you know, also the big brands and big retailers getting involved, it is really hitting a nerve on a global basis, you know, with almost everyone it touches. And so it's been just such a privilege to see this platform launch and take hold, and, you know, off we go.
Yeah, I hope it goes viral in every sense of the word. And I want to ask you one random question, because it's been bugging me since I heard you speak at Planet Forward, and then go a little bit deeper into the thought process of what everything you have to think about when you decide to take on a product. So my random question is, you said at Planet Forward, you have to first serve the medium and then serve the mission. And I wasn't writing it down because I was listening to you. I should have written it down. So what do you mean by that? You have to first serve the medium and then serve the mission.
This is very key for anyone, whether you're working at a company and trying to get them to be better, you know, care more for the planet or society, whether you're an external person like me trying to convince other people, other companies to do so, no matter what type of example you're in, this is really important if you're trying to embody purpose into an organization, which is, don't frame the idea based on what motivates you. So for example, what motivates me is to eliminate the idea of waste. That's what I'm dedicating my life to, and that's what is the mission of TerraCycle. What motivates our partners, whether it's Nestle or Walmart or, you know, all the other partners in between, may not be that. That may not be their primary sort of focus. That may not be how their employees get their bonuses, how they get promoted. That's not a bad thing. It's just the way it is. And instead of trying to convince them to care about the things you care about as passionately as you do, that's what most social entrepreneurs do, and that doesn't work in the long run. It's so important to focus on what they care about and not just understand it, but honor it. And honoring it means by really sort of walking in their shoes and understanding that that's the motivation. Like, Walmart's mission is not to eliminate the idea of waste. Walmart's mission is to give consumers the lowest price every day on branded goods. That's why they exist. They want, you know, anyone, no matter how, you know, what their wealth is, to be able to access products, you know, at the lowest possible price every day. That's why they exist. So if you frame within who you're trying to convince cares about, and then think about from that perspective how your idea can help them accomplish their goals, then you unlock the magic, which is then they embed you into their existence, which is how you then scale, how your whatever idea stays long-term, how it goes global, and how it becomes more effectively than a side project for a year that then after its launch goes away.
No wonder I stopped taking notes, because it was like, whoa, this is it. It's like, don't go in and say, I have a solution to all your problems. You go in and say, what's going on? What's the problem? And then decide how you can serve the mission. It's a total shift in mindset of selling something versus partnership is what I see it. But I want to know, when you decide to take on a product for recycling, and some of the most bizarre things ever that I couldn't even believe, because I went a long, long, long time on the website to see all of what you do now. So let's take, for example, anyone you want to pick. Cigarette butts to me is one. Gum, used chewing gum is another one, and dirty diapers. You don't just say, oh, let's start collecting that because there's a lot of those out there. And, you know, we have elder people using diapers or whatever. There's so much that has to go through the thought process of from collection to how you're going to use it. What do you have to think about when it comes to just one item?
Sure. So in the collection and recycling of things, which is our first, you know, business unit, it's important to note that, and you've really articulated it, that each waste stream is like a different animal that behaves completely differently and has to be dealt with differently and almost differently on a country-by-country basis. So that immediately seems like, oh my God, it's ridiculously complicated. The one nice thing that makes it actually achievable to even have this discussion is that it's always the same three questions we have to ask. Now, the answers may be different, but at least we always have the same three questions we have to go with. So the first question is, how do we collect it? That has to do with what collection device does it go into, like with Gillette, their recycling program that is now in the U.S. and launching in a number of other countries for blades and razors, needs a specialty bin to collect blades and razors in, because we just don't want anyone to, you know, somehow get cut and get infected. You have to really be careful with something that's sharp, like a razor blade. While how we collect chewing gum also is a different device, or how we collect diapers is a different device, how we collect cigarettes is a different device. We have to think about the physical device that the waste is collected in. And sometimes it's as simple as a cardboard box. If it's something like pens, put out a box. It doesn't matter. You know, there's no health and safety concern on collecting pens. Then we also, so within collection, we have to think about the physical device. How do we transport it from the location to one of our distribution centers in a safe and efficient way? And then a very important thing that is not sort of on the surface is, how do we actually do that in a location and a method where a consumer will actually bother doing it? Because even if we got the right bin out there and we know how to service it, if no one puts anything in it, what was the point? So that's the first sort of key category. And let me just do that for the three waste streams you had mentioned. So for diapers, we're today collecting diapers in these smart bins we developed. That are, the diaper platform is now in Amsterdam. It's going to be expanding to a few other cities, but for now in Amsterdam only. And it's a smart bin that you can access with your phone, and you can deposit your diapers into it. It weighs the diapers and then gives you coupons and other incentives depending on how many kilos of diapers you put into the bin. And those bins are located near nurseries, because of course there's a lot of diaper consumption in nurseries, and located near retailers, because of course people go to retailers to buy diapers. So both of those are very strategic locations where people will actually collect. And then we have to have special handling to pick them up and service them, because they're, while not a hazardous waste stream, they're not they're also not as simple as a pen or a stapler or something. On something like chewing gum, they're like cigarettes. We collect them typically, well, chewing gum is a little different. Chewing gum, we think about where's the biggest frequency of chewing gum consumption, and that is right now when you're walking on streets. That's usually where people consume most of the gum, which is a problem, because you spit it out and every little black dot on the sidewalk is a piece of chewing gum that remains there. That's how you know the chewing gum litter in a city. And basically, we put little bins all over the city where people can put the chewing gum into it, and we try to make the bins in a way where you won't put a lot of other things into it. You know, that's sort of key consideration, and then those get serviced and sent to one of our warehouses. And then finally, you mentioned cigarettes. So cigarettes, we do the same thing as chewing gum, do these litter systems in hundreds and hundreds of cities across the United States. But there's also places that have very high tobacco consumption, uniquely high tobacco consumption. And that's places like cruise ships, casinos. Those are the two biggest, where it's just disproportionately more tobacco is smoked. So those we target to become strategic locations, so that all over the casino, all the ashtrays are now going to be recycled versus disposed. So that's the first question, is always, how do we collect? The next question is, well, what do we do with it all when it shows up? How do we turn it into something that can be used again in a new product? How do we recycle it? So in that case, we have a team of designers that look at how can we leverage the method of upcycling to be able to turn into new things. And we also have a team of scientists that look at how can we, through various recycling processes, turn the waste into new raw materials. So there, let's go through the three. You know, diapers, they get radiated to sterilize any pathogens that may be inside, and they get shredded. Then they get separated into all their components, which is basically plastics, cellulosic material, organic material, and a thing called SAP, which is super absorbent polymer, which absorbs all of the liquids, you know, like urine that may be in a diaper. And each of those can be reconstituted into new products, not necessarily diapers, but, you know, be recycled into something else. Chewing gum is actually a rubber, and chewing gum is really, if you simplify it, rubber plus flavor plus sugar. And so once you chew it, you may notice the flavor goes away and the sweetness, and that you effectively consume, and what's left is a rubber, and rubber is sort of like a plastic that can be made into new plastic products. Chewing gum is not actually a food. It's more of like a rubber with flavor and sugar. And then the third one was cigarette butts. Those we shred. We separate the ash tobacco paper and compost it, and we take the filter, which is made from cellulose acetate, it's a type of plastic, and that gets made into, you know, things like park benches and other things like ashtrays and other materials. So that's the solution. And that not doesn't just include like how do we solve it, but finding the infrastructure to process it and companies who will buy these end products and make it into new things. And then there's the last question, which is the most important question by far. Who pays the bill and why?
Right.
Because what makes something not recyclable is not because it can't be recycled. What makes something not recyclable is that it costs more to collect and process than the results are worth. That's it. And frankly, what makes something recyclable is that it's profitable to do so. You know, here's a good example, right? Let's say if there was an envelope with $1,000 cash, say five meters from where you are sitting right now, and I told you I can give you a map to where that envelope is, and it's all yours. Would you bother taking me up on the map?
Like, right on.
Right
immediately.
On, right. Now, yeah, okay. So same scenario, but the only thing that changes is now that envelope is in the Antarctic. And I'll give you a map. It's waiting for you. Will you go get it?
The barriers are just insurmountable. You just it,
you'd
shut
pay more
your mind
probably,
out.
Right? Than the envelope is worth. Yeah.
Right.
And that is recycling, right? The dirty diaper is the envelope out in the Antarctic, and the aluminum can or a bar of gold or anything valuable is the envelope right beside you. So what we need to do is make it worthwhile for someone to pay the bill. And in all those examples, cigarette butts, chewing gum, dirty diapers, it costs more to collect and process than the results are worth. So how do you solve it? The key is you don't just look at the value of the material. You know, that's just a subsidy. You look at what other benefits could come to whomever pays for it for having such a program. So let me give you that for each of those waste streams you mentioned. Dirty diapers. In that example, who pays the bill? Well, it's a leading diaper manufacturer, Pampers, which is one of the biggest diaper companies or diaper brands in the world.
Right.
And they do it because parents care about diapers. They make up 3% of our landfills, you know, and of course, as you said, also half the diapers in the world are elderly care diapers for incontinence and other challenges that happen to us in older age. So people care about this because it's a big, heavy waste stream. It really bothers people. And they found that if they create a recycling program on diapers, people will prefer Pampers over the competition and they will sell more Pampers. It's not that people are buying more diapers. They're just shifting from brand X into Pampers, and that market share shift makes it a profit center and why P&G really likes the idea of funding diaper recycling. P&G owns Pampers, by the way. So that's diapers. If you take something like, say, chewing gum, they're the funder. Similar to diapers is Cadbury. Cadbury's owned by Mondelez, and they are a leading gum company. And they found that, this is interesting in gum is a declining idea in the world. People are chewing less and less gum every year. And a part of that is organizations like schools and other places are banning the idea of gum because it creates waste. So, of course, by now making gum recyclable, by getting it not to be stuck under the desks and thrown on sidewalks, it allows them to maintain the idea of gum. And it's a great tool to solve some of the issues that eliminate their ability to even be sold in an area. Then the third example is cigarettes. So in cigarettes, we have two funding sources or two different places where people have funded. One has been tobacco companies. So similar to Cadbury or Pampers, it's the manufacturer paying for it. And they're doing it there. They're not even allowed to market in cigarettes. You can't do any advertising, any communication. So they're not doing it as a way to the way that Cadbury and Pampers do it. They do it as a way to solve a major issue. You know, the number one most littered item in the world is cigarette butts. And they feel that it's a very good thing to proactively help solve it versus later being forced to, you know, through some legislation or something. You know, so that's been a very good tool for that. And then the other funding source, because some people don't want to use platforms that are funded by the tobacco companies, it could be funded directly by cities, directly by offices that may have a smoking area, by an airport. And that's also a great opportunity. And, you know, take an airport. Many airports run our cigarette recycling program. They do it because, you know, most anyone who's a smoker, and by the way, 20% of Americans smoke today, There's a lot of smoking at airports because people get that last cigarette in, you know, before they get on their long flight, or the opposite, they just got off their long flight and they've been craving a cigarette. And so having cigarette recycling is a very valuable addition to an airport. And so what you'll notice is that it's not about the value of the cigarette waste, it's about the other things that it brings, and that makes the economics now work.
And raises awareness about it. You have to make people aware of it, that it exists, and then you can get it out there. So there's that closing piece. But when I read about what the thought process is in terms of thinking of what I call the whole green enchilada, it's not just eating it. It's about everything that it takes to gather it, grow it, make it happen, and then consume it. It was mind-blowing. And one of the things I read, and I was literally laughing out loud, like, I am so not kidding. How do you take old toothbrushes, floss containers, and toothpaste tubes and turn them into playground equipment? Like, I want to be inside the brain of the person who thought that up. And I looked at some of the equipment's like, what?
Oh, this is the part I love. And you know, for me, what I like about working at TerraCycle is, take that example of that's through Colgate. They're the sponsor on that program, and with Colgate we work all over the world, from China, Australia, UK, even here in the US. And if you look at it, from the outside, before we go into the engine of what makes it work, we are able to recycle large amounts of toothpaste tubes and toothbrushes, packaging for toothbrushes, floss containers, things that otherwise are not recyclable anywhere in the world, which is a huge thing to feel great about. And I think in the U.S., we've built and deployed for schools in need, I think, just under 24 playgrounds, each worth about $100,000. So that's, what a great thing that instead of just spending money on I taste good or I work well, buy me commercial, right? So that part is a really great motivating factor. And I love the idea of, really putting purpose front and center, because you get to revel in that type of thing. But what is the sort of engine, right, that makes it happen is, yes, you need to have the science for how do you convert a toothbrush into a playground and do it at a very high quality, safety, all those things. But it's also, how do you make it work for what Colgate is really focused on, which is, people are only going to buy so many toothpaste tubes and toothbrushes because it's just one of those things we buy to brush our teeth. We're not going to suddenly, because there's a cool fancy toothbrush, brush our teeth more than we normally do. It's about preferring their product over someone else's. And how do you frame it in that method? And if you do, they'll really make it big. I mean, that's the key thing about what you had mentioned earlier about that idea of, we don't go into Colgate and say, you make a product that's not recyclable today, and we have a solution for your problem. That doesn't go so far, because then we're not understanding. But if we go in and say, hey, we know you want your toothbrush and toothpaste tubes to be recyclable, we can help you do that, and we can help you do that in a way that will also help you beat your competition, and people will prefer Colgate over whatever else, that suddenly, gets it working, and working at scale. So we can celebrate not one playground being built, but dozens of them.
So I want to be really aware of your time, and there's not going to be, I have like three more pages of questions, and I knew we weren't going to get to them all, but at some point, maybe if you come back, a lot of what you're doing with TerraCycle and you as a global leader that people are listening to, it's really about changing our mindset. And I invite our listeners to spend an afternoon, if you want, having fun at the TerraCycle.com website, because it is really fun and it will blow your mind like it does mine. But you have developed like a, what I call, it's a pyramid, and I'm a really visual learner, and it laid it out so well for me in terms of, the bottom of the pyramid being the least favored option to where we want to get to, which is prevention, or, the first R, reduce, and you talk about energy recovery next, and then recycling, and then reuse, and then minimization, and then prevention. And I just invite, we have thousands of listeners all over the world to just take a look at that so you can wrap your head around, here's where we are. We're not even really up to the third level, if you ask me, because most people don't recycle. And in our city, we're having major problems with where to put it. But I want people to do this. But I want to ask my three questions that I have to ask, because I'm excited about them. Is there anything that keeps you up nights in terms of how we can recycle this or something that's really bugging you that you haven't figured out yet? Because I'm sure your mind is always at work. You always see things as the next possibility. But is there something in particular that's bugging you?
Yeah, so I answer it this way. You know, instead of saying it's a particular object, right, that bugs me, because we've been, knock on wood, really successful at being able to recycle effectively everything. And, you know, where we haven't, it's usually where the law would prevent us from doing so, you know, where it's illegal to recycle that object because of health and safety reasons, like certain medical waste and that sort of thing. But net, you know, everything can be recycled with some thought and those sort of ideas of how do you collect, how do you process, and how do you fund. What really keeps me up at night is that there is this, it's an inverted process of creation of products. Now, what do I mean by that is that as I could today as an entrepreneur invent any product I want without asking anyone if it's a product that is easy to recycle or not recyclable or what the garbage industry thinks about it or what will happen to it at its end of life. I can put it out there, sell millions of units, and then maybe one day ask, oh, is this a good thing for the planet to exist? And that's really challenging, that's how it works today, because then the recycling industry is always playing catch up all the time. And, you know, when companies change the way they make their package, even in something that you may think is a totally minor change, it may have massive ramifications on is it going to have a good end of life or a bad end of life. And there needs to be more conversation. If you are listening to this and you're a manufacturer and you're going to make an object, whether you're an entrepreneur or work at a massive company, check and ask, you know, a local recycler or call us or whatever and find out, is this object going to be good at the end or not good at the end? Now, why I'm really excited about Loop is that in Loop we have rules. And people have to design into the rules. So effectively, they do have to check before the product is sold. But that's not the norm, right? So we need to proactively do that. Because if not, what keeps me up at night is what's going to be invented tomorrow that's going to be yet another headache.
Yeah, there's always going to be something. And then my next question is, what's it like to work at TerraCycle? I believe you've created a social enterprise, not just a company. What's it like to work there? What type of corporate culture have you created?
It's I'd say first and foremost, what comes to my mind are like words like fun, very stimulating, highly innovative, you know, really bright, colorful, exciting. You know, there's a lot of stress and we have to perform, but it's all those things. It's very collaborative, very open. If you go to our website, you know, you'll see a lot of pictures. You know, all of our offices around the world are made entirely from waste. We have a big graffiti culture where the outside of our buildings, and we're talking, you know, quite a lot of office space at this point, are repainted completely every week, you know, by local graffiti artists all over the world, from Tokyo, you know, to Sao Paulo, to London, you know, so on and so forth. We really pride ourselves on transparency and sharing as much information so everyone knows what's going on so that we can all be on the same page and think about how to improve. And I would say we're also looking at, you know, what's next, how to never settle and think about, you know, how can we keep, you know, furthering that mission of eliminating the idea of waste, even if it means one of our ideas undoes one of the older ones, you know, that's, I think there's nothing wrong with that. So it's that the type of, but it's also very intense, you know, the pressure is very high. You know, people feel very driven, not just because it's a business, but also because it's trying to do the right thing.
Right.
But there's a great responsibility that comes with that. And it's, you know, there's definitely pressure to accomplish, you know, what we're focused on.
And you just have to go to the website, and you know it's fun. And when we saw you at Planet Forward, another partner of ours, Brink Media, was there, and we will come. you made the invitation, and we will come, and
totally
we will
should.
Video it.
And you know what? By the way, speaking of that, we're not filming now because we've been too busy, but we had our own TV show. This airs in, you know, 22 countries, National Geographic Channel, Pivots, some pretty, you know, good networks. It was called Human Reason. We did 4 seasons, and it's a comedy, so it's a little bit, you know, fictitious, but you get a good taste of what life is like inside TerraCycle. And you can, today, I think in the US, you can get that on Amazon and iTunes. If you type in something like human resources and then maybe the word TerraCycle, it should come up. And that gives you a good little inside taste. But do note, that is a note that would be called like, sort of, you know, it's not quite real. It's not a documentary. It's a bit more of like a reenactment, if you will, but definitely all based on reality with all the people who were doing it.
I am so going to check it out because everything about it makes me smile. So one last question before last word for me. Do you have a proudest accomplishment for you or the company? One thing that you say, I want everybody to remember that we did X. I don't know how you could, but it's a good question.
Yeah, I would say this. What gets me proud is not necessarily a singular accomplishment, but seeing our work in some corner of the world randomly there without sort of, you know, us having put it there, you know, seeing our logo on a chip bag in Mexico when, you know, when you're traveling and people recycling it without even knowing that, that you're associated with the idea. Seeing the work out in the real world, and that to me is really exciting. And the more you see it, I think the more you see that scale is there and coming.
Okay, and I lied. I really didn't lie intentionally, but there's one last question, and I would have kicked myself if I didn't remember to ask it because I ask it at the end of every show. We love to have a call to action. So with all that we've covered and all the exciting things that are possible, do you have one thing or two things that the average everyday consumer can start doing to make a difference and to further the mission of TerraCycle, which is the elimination of waste? What's the takeaway? What's the call to action?
Yeah, absolutely. I have one thing, which is shop with the understanding that you are voting for the future you want. And a simple way to think about it is this. What I'm not asking you to do is become an expert on everything to do with every product, because that would be unreasonable. But think about it this way. Next time you go shop, whatever you buy, two more will appear tomorrow. One to replace the thing you bought, and one extra to signify the trend. And one less of everything you didn't buy will appear tomorrow, because there's nothing to replace, but there is a signal to the trend. The crazy thing is that is exactly what happens. And just maybe will you shop differently, keeping that in your heart.
Love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. And now the last words for me. I got goosebumps. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out what I think of Tom Szaki. As the thought leader for TerraCycle, he is changing the world. He's closing loops. He's moving the green needle forward more than any single individual that I could think of while preparing for this show. He's tireless in his efforts, and he gets to stand with him to make and gets others to stand with him to make our world a cleaner, safer, and healthier place for all of us. And maybe that's why over 220 million people in 21 countries have joined TerraCycle to help collect waste and recycle enough waste to raise over $44 million for charities all over the world. What I'm going to reflect on is asking myself this question. Even though I admire Tom for his work, the impact of TerraCycle, I want to think about what it has made in the years since they began their work. And here's the question that got me. Why haven't I taken action to join them in their mission to do the right thing, the smart thing with waste that I create and that my family creates? It slapped me up the side of the head as I was prepping for the show, and I realized once again that if it is to be, it's up to me, and so I'm in. I hope that all of you who listen will visit TerraCycle.com and get fired up and get excited about how you can join me in stepping up our game when it comes to being disruptors for good and champions for Mother Earth. Let me know if you do. And as always, thank you so much for being a part of my world. And Tom Szaki, thanks for being wonderful you. Please keep on keeping on. And please keep your invitation open for me to come visit sometime and see the TerraCycle world for myself. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.